funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is faith changing in modern America? While some people lament the decline in attendance at many traditional Christian churches, my guest would argue that rather than becoming less religious, U.S. society is simply religious in a different way. Tony Jones is National Coordinator of Emergent Village and a doctoral fellow at Princeton Theological Seminary. He's come to believe that emergent approaches to spirituality, which embrace what he calls open definitions of churches and congregations, are not only healthy for the faithful but vital to the survival of their beliefs. His book, The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier, is soon to be released in paperback. Tony, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Good to see you.
How does the emergent church define Christianity?
Well, the emergent church is a particularly, some would say, postmodern version of Christianity. And I guess it's coming into bloom right now. It's very new. An analogy might be this. There are still a lot of people in our world who, when they want a reliable article on something, would go to the Encyclopedia Britannica. But for a lot of people vaguely under the age of 40-ish, they feel very comfortable going to Wikipedia, a repository of human knowledge in which anyone can participate. There are still a lot of people who like to go to a church where they sit in a pew and someone stands up in front in a suit or a robe and talks for 55 minutes and kind of runs the show and interprets scripture and passes out the communion. But there are a lot of people, a growing number of people in the U.S. and around the world, particularly in Western cultures, who want a more participatory version of Christianity. And so these churches are what you might call open source, like the church I go to in Minneapolis called Solomon's Porch. There are a couple here in DFW that I am very familiar with. And that's it. It's not so much changing the definition of Christianity as it is, what does it mean to be Christian? What does it mean to be Christian corporately in a church environment?
So initially, the sort of mega church movement was supposed to fill that gap of relevancy for people. It was a little more relaxed in some ways than sort of high church services. Obviously, we're not talking about mega churches at all here. These are small gatherings in this case.
Yeah, I mean, to give like a totally oversimplified version of what's happened in the last 50 years in American Protestantism is, you know, baby boomers grew up going to First United Methodist and Westminster Presbyterian and All Saints Episcopal downtown big steeple churches. They, you know, went on way to college and they protested a little bit and smoked a little grass and, you know, then and dropped out of church. But then in the 70s and early 80s, they settled down, moved out to the suburbs, had children. They didn't go back to Westminster Presbyterian and All Saints Episcopal downtown. They went to these new, big, gleaming, shopping mall-like megachurches in the second and third ring suburbs. It's happened in Dallas. It happened in Minneapolis. It's happened in almost every metropolitan area in the States. What you're finding among Gen X and millennials or Gen Y is, one thing you see is less of them are going back to church when they're settling down and having kids. And there is some disillusionment with the big seeker-sensitive megachurch suburban version of Christianity. And you are seeing kind of a re-gentrification of younger people moving back into urban areas, trying to kind of reclaim urban areas and meeting in smaller, more kind of organic, gritty versions of Christianity. We meet at a church that used to be, well, it's owned by the United Methodist in South Minneapolis. It was abandoned. The congregation disbanded 3 or 4 years ago, and we found it for rent on Craigslist because they had this empty building and they're
based on the Wikipedia model.
Yeah, for sure, exactly. So, you know, and we and there are churches here in DFW like Journey meets in Dallas, and there's a church called Church in the Cliff in Oak Cliff, and there's a U-Catastrophe in Fort Worth. And there are other kind of experimental versions of Christianity, and they all tend to be a bit more urban, younger people, experimental, a bit more adventurous, both theologically and then in how you kind of govern and do church things. How you everything from how you kind of vote on who you are as a community to what it means to have a sermon or how you serve communion, things like that.
What's the role of sort of Christian doctrine in defining these individual groups? Because my understanding is it's not that, that some big church has sprung up and they, these are little sort of franchises. This is each community deciding for itself how it's going to operate.
Yeah, right. I mean, there are a lot of churches like ours, Solomon's Porch in Minneapolis or Journey in Dallas that are independent, not denominationally affiliated. There are lots of other iterations of the emerging church that are affiliated with denominations, but they're often renegotiating their relationship with a denomination. And quite honestly, as you surely know, in mainline Christianity, which would be kind of on the leftward side of Protestantism in America, denominations aren't really in a very good position to demand much of new, young churches with young pastors and that have some vibrancy. They're kind of just glad to have people trying new things. What's been interesting in the emerging movement is that at the beginning, there was a lot of interest from evangelicals. In fact, the group I'm a part of, Emergent Village, we got our start with help from a foundation here in Dallas called Leadership Network, which is an evangelical group. But as we and it's what's interesting in evangelicalism is experimentation in forms of church is great. Like try some new music, meet in a middle school auditorium. You know, Rick Warren's famous for starting a church in like a middle school auditorium wearing flip-flops and a Hawaiian shirt. When people were used to robes and a choir and an organ, that was really edgy in the early 80s. But in evangelicalism, where there's a lot of latitude in method, there's really not much latitude in doctrine. That's pretty much set. The interesting thing is on the other side of Christianity, there's a lot of freedom in talking about the gospel, how you read the Bible, what should even be in the Bible. You've probably had some Bart Ehrman, Marcus Borg. These are the kind of, the figureheads of that version of Christianity. But what's interesting is on the left of Protestantism, where there's lots of freedom in the doctrine, you don't mess with the method. So, like, I have a friend who ended up dropping out of Episcopal Seminary, but I wrote a little bit about him in the book, because what he found was so interesting was in theology class or Bible class, like, anything goes. But in liturgy class, you don't get to change a word from the Book of Common Prayer when you're doing the Eucharistic liturgy. So there's a certain kind of reification on both sides of American Protestantism. And what you find, I think, in emergent churches is more interest in playing with those, making those more malleable, both the doctrine and the theology, talking about it, discussing it, wrestling with it, and with the method. And so we tend to kind of make people on both sides a bit uncomfortable.
Do you think that tendency that both sides, we'll call them the left and the right, but those are obviously not ideal terms, but
right.
Why is there always that anchor of one element that really cannot and does not change? It seems for a lot of people that it's not a religion unless there's something that's immutable.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've spent the last few days at Baylor, and those kind of questions came up both at Baylor and at Truett, the seminary affiliated with Baylor, and I did some stuff at both schools. And there are those questions consistently come up. Well, but what are the boundaries? Where do you draw the line? Where do you no longer become when are you no longer a Christian or a Christian church or something of this nature? Those questions aren't that interesting to me, actually. I guess why they come up is your question. That is an interesting question, because they do seem to come up, and I think that people are looking for some kind of anchor or some kind of safety, especially in an age where we're really confronted with globalization, or call it radical pluralism, or call it what you will. And, you know, a lot of Christians were really bemoaning this study that came out a couple weeks ago that said, it got lots of, news coverage, that 10 or 15% of Americans are nones, N-O-N-E-S, have no religious affiliation. And this is just shocking. This is a threefold increase from any other study that's ever been done. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because I think this increase in secularism is a result of that the for the first time in literally in human history, that's an option. Like, humanism is an option. People are not culturally bound to affiliate with a religion. And that's just that's never even been an option for 10,000 years. There's always been kind of – it's only culturally appropriate to believe in some kind of divine being that's in charge of the whole thing. And now for the first time, it's an option that you don't have to believe that.
Do you imagine, though, that there have always been maybe that 10 or 15% always existed, but they just were sort of under the covers?
Right. It's this funny thing about I can't remember who it is, but we have our first congressional representative in Washington who's an atheist, right? And that was big news. Now, of course, we've had atheists before who've been in Congress, but you couldn't ever say it.
They just showed up somewhere every Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And here we have someone who's an avowed atheist, and that's a sign of what's happening. And why I think that's a positive development is that people actually now have the option to opt into a religious system. And I think one of the things that you see in the struggle in mainline Christianity and why denominations are, hemorrhaging members every year is that there's been a little bit of resting on their laurels. Like, well, this is what we do. This is what Methodists do. This is how we worship. This is how we organize ourselves. This is how, Presbyterian polity or, governance works. And people are like, well, why? It doesn't make sense for me anymore. It doesn't make sense for us anymore. And so we're going to go look for a church that works for us. The other side of that coin is, And evangelical churches get accused of this sometimes, is kind of catering to American consumerism, even in religion. Like, hey, we'll give you what you want. How can we meet your needs so that you'll come to our church? So I think we're really at this time where things are kind of starting to break up. And this is what happened, I think, in the 16th century at the Reformation, is that the Catholic magisterium was kind of resting on its laurels. And I have this little image in my book of the gospel being like lava, and it had cooled over time, and what had been built on it were structures that weren't particularly of the gospel, and so the selling of indulgences, say, and it just got to be completely out of hand to the point that people like Martin Luther or John Calvin, etc., something happened in the 16th century that was incredibly exciting. And there was a rethinking both of how we do church. So do we need a pope? Can we translate the Bible into German? These were this was shocking stuff.
It was heresy.
Yeah, right. So there was a rethinking of that. And then if you read the theology of Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and Menno Simons and all the people who were part of the 16th century Reformation, there was also a rethinking of theology. What does it mean to be Christian? Who was Jesus Christ? How do we read the Bible? So it was everything was thrown up in the air. And I think we're right on the brink of that happening again.
Tony Jones is my guest. He is National Coordinator for Emergent Village. You can find them online at emergentvillage.org. His book is called The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a doctoral fellow at Princeton Theological Seminary and National Coordinator for Emergent Village. His book is called The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier, and his name is Tony Jones. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. You talked, Tony, about people, some people feeling very constricted by either doctrinal policies of churches or the idea that worship has to be conducted in a certain way. On the other hand, for a great many people who are thinking people, there is still a sort of expediency, if not comfort, to the fact that some of it seems to be preordained, that it's not something that you're expected to give a great deal of thought to. It's the way Methodists have always done things, to quote you from earlier.
Yeah. For sure, I think there's a great percentage of the vast percentage of the population that they don't want necessarily, and I don't begrudge them this, they don't want to necessarily go on Sunday morning or Sunday evening to their house of worship and have to feel like this, like we have to figure this stuff all out. But there are some of us who do want that. Like I want to go to a place where I have to, I'm not pandering here, to think, you know, to...
Feel free to pander. Okay. It's encouraged.
Okay. We really want to think. We don't just want the person who has been to a 3-year graduate school called seminary and has a couple letters after her or his name to get a monologue every Sunday night. We want actually to mix it up. And some of us think that the way we're faithful to the theologians whom we respect so much, Augustine, Tertullian, Irenaeus, Aquinas, Luther, Calvin, is by doing what they did, which was to theologize, to really wrestle over the Trinity, over the divinity of Christ, over what it means to be the church, over how Christians interact with culture, over any number of issues. That's what theologians have done. And so we think that is actually the most faithful thing to do. Not to say, look, it's been decided. That stuff is, quote unquote, off the table. We want to put everything back on. Everything should be on the table. We don't think just because Augustine wrote De Trinitate that that's the final word. We think that's an incredibly compelling treatise on the Trinity, and we should continue his conversation. And you're right. I mean, it is not for everyone, but I am sure that there are any number of listeners driving around in their car thinking, I mean, look, that's how people live their lives. When I was at Baylor yesterday and at Truett the day before, 50 years ago, a seminary professor at Truett would have stood in front of the classroom and he would have read his lecture notes for 55 minutes or 75 minutes, and then that would have been class dismissed, and that was it. I went to a class where they sat in a, you know, concentric fashion around tables. The professor was a woman, and she was teaching about practical theology, and we had, for the hour I was in the class, this great interplay of back and forth. Now, so education has changed dramatically at a Baptist seminary. And yet, if you were to go to most Baptist churches, they're still operating on Sunday mornings the same way they did 50 years ago, where one person stands up in front and basically has a monologue. There might be some announcements and there might be some different forms of music, but in general it follows the same cadence and rhythm, where everything else in society is changing around us and it's unilateral communication is happening less and less. As you know, as somebody in media, I mean, there's a lot more back and forth in our society. And so there are just churches that are exploring this and increasingly seminaries that are exploring this and Christian nonprofits that are exploring this.
Well, I think, Tony, there are some fascinating parallels when you describe the way people interact in emergent churches with what was happening with the earliest Christians in the first and second and third centuries. So if you accept that parallel, I want you to talk about how you know that you don't recalcify at some point. You don't have these small people who get together weekly for months and years, and then they finally sort of agree that, that in their group they've come to what must be true, and then you have the same process sort of setting itself up all over again.
Yeah. Max Weber kind of prophesied this, the founder of modern sociology, and he did a study of French clericalism, and he said what happens in any kind of revival or reformation is the first generation of the revivalists, it's kind of like free love, give everything away, like it hand out the things of God freely and get everyone involved in this very exciting time. And what Weber wrote, he called it the routinization of the charisma. In other words, in the second generation, the children of the revivalists say, we got mouths to feed. Like we have to make a little dough off this. So look, we will give you communion, but it's not free. Like there's an economic transaction that has to take place, or we'll baptize your babies, but look, you have to pay us. You have to tithe so we can buy these fancy robes so you can do this. How another reformation of the church, if the emerging church is indeed a reformation, which I think time will tell, how we are become the first revival to, you know, not go down the Weberian road of routinization, I don't know. I will say that we're doing some things differently than our parents did them. We're not building mega churches in the suburbs. We're renting spaces. We're a little bit more light on our feet. We're not so beholden to these, you know, massive denominations with multi-million dollar budgets and headquarters in Chicago or New York or Nashville or Louisville. So there's more freedom to that. And I do think that social media is allowing us to network in ways that simply was impossible before. You're right to say that in the early church, it was more informal. You might say it was more loosey-goosey, that people met before 315-ish. People met in houses, domus ecclesia, these house churches. And they'd get a letter from Paul on parchment, or they'd get a gospel, and they'd read it, and they would talk about it. And then, you know, the church became institutionalized after the Emperor Constantine was converted, and we started having hierarchies and bishops. And I do think, I don't know that we're never going to go back, right? We're not going back. But the way that people in the emergent church network using social media, cell phones, Facebook, blogs, Twitter, it's allowed a much more rapid and informal version of connection that simply just wasn't available 50 years ago. You had to go through your denominational headquarters. If you wanted to do a mission trip in Guatemala, you went through your denominational headquarters to find out the name of a missionary from your denomination in Guatemala. Now you Google, you know, whatever in Guatemala, and within 5 minutes you're sending an email off to somebody, and you might be on a plane 3 months later to do it, and you've cut the denominational headquarters out of the loop, you know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Tony Jones is here. His book is called The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier. Let's speak to Bob in Austin. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm interested what Tony might say about the emergent frontier outside of the shores of the U.S. and how that is different from the U.S. and how it informs what's going on in the United States.
Thanks, Bob. An author, a well-known author in the emergent world, is a guy named Brian McLaren, and some of your listeners, Chris, will have heard of him. And he refers to, instead of postmodernism, he prefers the term post-colonialism. And what's happened around the world, it's been interesting, because like in the Global South, Philip Jenkins has written a lot about this, it's become pretty well-known, that in the Global South, Christianity is burgeoning, but it's in a very conservative fashion. It's growing conservative Catholicism and conservative Pentecostalism. But, you know, anytime you have that, you have a few renegades or refugees who don't fit into that system. And I guess what we've found from our perspective in the States is that all around the world there are these renegades from the bigger systems who want to connect with people around the globe who are thinking differently. So we have a gathering in June, every June, this will be the third year in a row, in Africa, and we've had 400 or 500 African pastors show up who just mainly want to connect with people around the world who aren't beholden to the bigger, more conservative systems of Christianity. There's a group in Latin America called Rio del Camino, which is kind of a sister group to Emergent Village, a group of kind of progressive theologians and church planters. So we're making connections around the world. And again, it's really made possible by the internet more than anything else.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My background is I was raised as a Coptic Orthodox. I'm originally from Ethiopia. And in my second year in college, I became a member of a youth movement. I converted to evangelical churches. But after I moved here to United States, I started challenging the status quo of the evangelical church itself. For example, your guest was mentioning the concept of communion, which in New Testament basically is not practiced as it is usually done in our churches, and the concept of tithing and all those legal issues that pretty much were carried out from the Old Testament. And historically, church used to be a little bit open for a different idea, but at this point, it looks like everybody who has a different idea is being excommunicated from the church, including myself and many others. So my question is, all the evangelical churches have challenged a certain topic of the previous existed established church, whereas they stop themselves challenging their own convictions. And how far is the emerging church willing to challenge the status quo? And second is, how can it maintain its structural integrity if it's open for pretty much every challenge that's out there, theologically or structurally? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Interesting question. Thanks, Thomas.
Thank you, Thomas. I have a friend named Phyllis Tickle who's written a book called The Great Emergence, and she begins the book by quoting an Episcopal bishop who says that every 500 years the church has a big rummage sale in which it looks around the attic and it says, what's the stuff we've kind of accumulated over the last five centuries that really doesn't have much to do with the gospel, and drags it out to the curb and says, we don't really need this stuff. Like, whatever it may be, you might say it's the robes or the denominational bureaucracy or whatever the case may be. You drag it out and you say, let's just keep the few things around that we need. Let's have a house cleaning kind of thing. I think people resist that because some people, they've put a lot of weight into those things that some of us think should be dragged to the curb. And so there is fighting. There is, I mean, in the Evangelical Theological Society, which is the academic guild for evangelical theologians, they have over the last few years had some votes and voted some of their membership out. You're not evangelical. Well, what's funny is evangelical isn't a, it's not a denomination. It's not a bounded set. So like, who gets to decide who's evangelical? Because you poke around a little bit and you find people like, yeah, I'm Roman Catholic, but I'm evangelical, small e. You know, I might not be culturally evangelical, capital E, like listen to James Dobson and vote Republican and these quote-unquote things that are happening. And yet, what's the big story, right, since Obama's election? There was another article in the Washington Post last week, the crack up of the religious right. The religious right is breaking up. It's not going to be like it has been. So I think some evangelicals are, you know, struggling when a guy like Thomas brings questions to the fore that to say you don't get to ask these questions, because it's the increase in questions that can be very threatening to people in this age. Yeah.
Let's go next to Matt in Dallas. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, my question is for Tony, how do you define church? That's it. Just what is church, a church, the church, however you want to take it. What's your definition?
I try not to define church. I don't think that church the way – one of the things that my friends and I talk about is church in kind of mathematical set theory. I've already mentioned, you know, bounded set, Chris. And you might think of – if you're a Catholic, it's a bounded set. You're either a communicant in the Catholic Church, or you're not a communicant in the Catholic Church. You can't be kind of Catholic. according to the according
like
to the Vatican.
Lots of Catholics would disagree with
that.
But I know
according
what you're
to
saying.
The Vatican, like from their perspective, you either are or you aren't, and you're either a member in good standing of a Presbyterian church or you're not. Evangelicalism isn't set up on a bounded set model; it's a centered set. Like we have these five fundamentals that were decided in the 1890s, or you know, evangelicalism. You have three things: you believe in the divinity of Christ, you believe in the authority of Scripture, and you believe that there's good news we should share. You know, whatever evangelicals will debate, but it's kind of a centered set. Like, let's all put our hands in on the center, but we're not going to say you can't be evangelical if you baptize babies instead of baptize adults. Or stuff like that. But the problem with centered set like evangelicalism is it inevitably, I think, devolves to bounded set. And that's what you have now. Well, you're not evangelical because you don't believe X, Y, or Z.
Or because you do believe X,
Y, or Z. Or because you do believe X, Y, or Z. Right, exactly. And so a lot of people are, you know, you find in evangelical magazines, oh, the emergent people, they're not evangelical because whatever the case may be. It's the same goes for us, I think, when you talk about church. So at Solomon's Porch, we work really hard to, you know, every Sunday night at our worship gathering, the first thing that's said after we sing a song or two is, hi, welcome to Solomon's Porch. This is one of the things we do each week. We all get together, we sing some songs, we share some food, we talk about the Bible. But it's simply one of the things we do because we believe it's a more church in general and the church worldwide, because Matt's question was about both, is a relational set. It's more like the internet, or it's more like, pardon me, but Al-Qaeda. It's like a bunch of cells. There's no center, there's no boundary, but there's a lot of the relationships and the networks are what hold everybody together. So it's very difficult to define, but it's there.
Tony Jones is my guest. His book is called The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Tony Jones is here. He's National Coordinator of Emergent Village and a doctoral fellow at Princeton Theological Seminary. His book is called The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Tony, what do you say to critics who say allowing everyone to argue about and ultimately debate the rules and then decide for themselves what makes sense just opens the door wide to moral relativism?
Yeah, that's that. I hear that a lot. Moral relativism, heresy, you know, etc. First of all, my experience, I mean, talk about first experientially being a part of a church where it's very open. Our sermons on Sunday evenings are about half monologue and half dialogue. It's really an open floor. No one wears a microphone. We don't believe in lapel mics or headset mics because we don't want one person's voice to be amplified over against everyone else in the community because it breeds passivity. And we don't want passivity. We want activism, even in the sermon time. Okay, so this is what we do. Never once has heresy run amok in our sermon discussion time. If somebody says something that challenges what others believe to be biblical orthodoxy, it's amazing how many hands shoot up as soon as somebody says something that maybe seems a little bit off or a little bit non-biblical or something. Hands shoot up all over the room because other people want to. I mean, it really is a group dynamic, I think, that roots out those heresies. And, I mean, I hope this isn't, you know, I hope it's not too soon or anything around here. But, you know, being down in Waco in the last few days, like David Koresh, he didn't end his sermon and then say, so, What'd y'all think about that? Let's have a little open dialogue for 20 minutes. The way that heresies, sects, and especially cults even get started is because people are silenced, not because we open up the floor. It's because all the power is held by one person or just a few people, and everyone else is told the way it's going to be. And so, a lot of us, because we are enamored of postmodern philosophy and how postmodern theory was really pushing against a lot of the abuses of the 20th century that led to things like the Holocaust or the Cambodian pogroms or things like this, we think it's safer for us to let everybody have a voice. And it doesn't lead to moral relativism. It does lead to some uncomfortable conversations, especially if you have been to seminary and been trained that, look, you're the authority. You may not be the authority on repairing lawnmowers in your congregation or on putting an IV in, but you're the authority on biblical orthodoxy. And when you change that around and change your posture and say, my job is actually to facilitate a conversation in which people come to these conclusions as a group and therefore take more ownership of those decisions that they've made. It can be frightening, and it goes against a lot of what people learn of how you lead a congregation. But ultimately, I think it's very freeing for both the pastor and for the people in the congregation.
Well, I mean, that being said, group dynamics will tell you that in any group of people, natural leaders emerge. Do you have to fight against everyone else's tendency to sort of look to one person or a couple of individuals to really express what a lot of people are thinking?
You have to fight like crazy against it. And it's why it's much harder to say, look, I'm going into a 75-year-old Presbyterian church as a 30-year-old pastor, and I'm going to change it into an emergent place. We're going to have conversations. We're going to write our own music. We're going to hang art on the walls. We're going to meet in the round. People are like, that's not how we do it here. It's easier to do what a lot of us have done and start your own place from scratch. There is still leadership, but part of leadership in these kind of congregations is to divest oneself of the power that accumulates around seminary degrees, around being male, around having a microphone clipped on your lapel. And so that is leadership, is divesting yourself of that and saying, look, this is all of our community. We all have to pitch in on this thing. And people are socialized to be passive in church. If you grew up in church, now people who didn't grow up in church kind of, there was this joke on Desperate Housewives a couple years ago where one of the characters went to church for the first time in decades and she raises her hand in the middle of the sermon. And her friend's like, you don't get to do that here. So for people who are raised in church, you're socialized to sit in a certain way, to act in a certain way. It's one of the reasons why when you go to a lot of emergent churches, you'll find couches, you'll find household furniture in a concentric fashion. Not because, hey, we're trying to be hip and reach the Gen Xers. It's because to uproot the pews and to bring in furniture that breeds conversation, you're socialized from a young age that when you sit on a couch, you talk to the person next to you. You're socialized from a young age. When you sit on a pew, you don't talk. You look forward, and maybe for 30 seconds during the welcome time, you turn to the person around you and shake their hand. So the reason to even change up the interior design of a church is to try to break those social conventions that you're talking about. But that's leadership. I mean, that is leadership to make those decisions for sure.
An email from Meg in Hawkins asks how one goes about finding an emergent church group.
Google it. I mean, that's the best way is to Google emergent church and there are networks. I mean, there's a massive kind of blogosphere. There are all sorts of groups on Facebook about it. People can easily find me online and email me about that. And I've had the great opportunity to travel a lot and know of a lot of churches. Or if I don't know of one, I know of somebody who might know of one in that area. So. Yeah.
Do you worry that it's not scalable, that this amazing culture that exists in these little groups can't really work if every Christian 100 years from now wants to be part of an emergent church?
Yeah, it's not scalable. You're right, Chris. It at our church at Solomon's Porch, I mean, when you don't wear a microphone, it mitigates growth past a certain point. I mean, you can't get more than 200 or so people in the room if no one's wearing a microphone, because you just can't. And we have kids running around, and people are eating food, and
but then you don't want to start your own church because you've got this group of people that you're friends with.
Right. So it is tricky. So one of the things we try to do is like we try to change the metrics of growth. People always say, well, your church is supposed to grow. There was this great focus on growth in the last 20 years of church, but it was always about numeric growth. And the fact of the matter is, there are other ways to measure growth. I mean, you don't ask a great artist, listen, you haven't cranked out nearly as many paintings as you did last year. You're not growing as an artist. And you don't say to a mother and father, look, you've quit procreating. You're not growing as a family anymore, right? There are other ways that we're trying. I don't know the answer exactly, but I know that we're trying to think of growth differently. And we know that these little communities, I think, will spawn other communities.
Let's go next to Jay in Dallas. Hello, Jay.
Hello, this is Jay Nice from Dallas, Texas. Originally the charter member from Lubbock, been a part of Emergent since 1988. And I was wondering if people like Jones, Padgett, Gandrett, is there enough fuel in the tank to make this thing survive and work out in the future?
Jay Nice, thanks for that. One of the things that we do that's a little tricky and maybe a bit disingenuous or slippery is I try to avoid answering hypothetical questions. As you can imagine, Chris, we get asked a lot. People will come, well, what would you do if? So then it's a gay couple came to your church and wanted to get married, or a bunch of Mormons came and took over your church, or everyone in your church decided to become atheist. I mean, these are like in the last week, these are the hypothetical questions.
I don't envy your job.
And there are enough dilemmas to deal with in the real world that I really don't have interest in asking, answering hypothetical questions, because I don't know what's going to happen. So Jay Nice mentioned some of the leaders, quote unquote leaders of the emergent church, me and Doug Padgett and Mark Scandrett and Brian McLaren, things like that. I don't know. I don't know what our children will do with this. I don't know what we'll do with it. We got into this really 10 years ago because we were really interested in doing theology and starting communities of faith. We could find a lot of people who are interested in starting communities of faith, but they weren't really interested in doing theology. We could find a lot of people who were interested in doing theology, but they were seminary professors and they didn't want to start churches. We were at the nexus of these two endeavors. And so we just found each other by, luck or providence, and have been on this really fun road trip ever since then. And I don't know. I don't know if it's sustainable. I don't know if it's scalable. I don't know if we're going to run out of gas. Not today. We're not going to run out of gas.
Are there people coming to emergent Christianity from purely secular or even agnostic backgrounds?
Yes. I mean, at Solomon's Porch, there are. Minnesota, where I'm from, and it's the same in Dallas, I'm quite sure, is a pretty churchy area. I mean, most people, even if they've fallen away from the church, they were baptized and confirmed, because we're a very Lutheran Catholic area in Minnesota. In Dallas, it'd be a bit different. But most people have some kind of cultural residue Christianity that they bring to Solomon's Porch. It's rare that somebody has absolutely none. An interesting story of somebody who did have none is Doug Padgett, who's the pastor of Solomon's Porch, and wrote a book, A Christianity Worth Believing, in which he writes about that, about how dramatic it was to come to Christianity from really completely from the outside, and what a set of fresh eyes that gives him, vis-a-vis those of us who were brought up in it and kind of do things because we've always done them.
I have time for one more call, and that comes from James in Plano. Hey, James.
Hi. I wanted to take a point with your guest regarding mission trips. I have a problem with doing Google mission work trips versus those of what you call established religions. A lot of missionaries out there in the field rely upon a continual source of funds or workmanship or whatever you want to call it, human resources to get a job done. But if I understood you correctly, you're talking about, well, it doesn't really matter. Just Google whatever you find. You might get lucky, and you might get something that you really appeal to. And I think you're missing the point of what mission work is all about.
Thanks. I'm not necessarily making a value judgment on whether people do that. I'm just saying this is what's happening. I mean, the very lines along which we communicate are being redrawn by social media. And so we may like it or not like it, but like missionaries are, if we consider mission, but even this understanding of missionaries, that they're people from our white Western culture whom we send out to these other unsaved, lost places, and then we support them to go do the work that we'd rather not do. Even that's kind of collapsing, and missionaries are having to really reevaluate that very thing, how what they do is sustainable. And so it's a two-way thing. I mean, I think both on the fact that in the Western culture, people are going to find different ways to connect with people in other cultures, and the people in those other cultures, whether they be missionaries who've come from us or indigenous type persons, are also going to find different ways to communicate with us and to, you know, ask us to share our resources with them and things like that.
If you can't assume that growth will mean a vast number of individuals sort of switching to an emergent practice, is it enough for you that this, that the existence of emergent Christianity changes traditional churches?
I find that, on the one hand, gratifying, and think that's great that what the experiments that we've done have been beneficial to more conventional versions of Christianity. On the other hand, I don't know if those conventional versions of Christianity are salvageable. I don't know that the precipitous decline in membership in the mainline denominations of United Methodist, Episcopal, United Church of Christ, Presbyterian Church USA, I don't see that trend reversing. So American Christian, just like we talk here about the crack up of the religious right, and we hear about the decline of the mainline Protestant denominations, something new is coming, and I don't personally think it's likely that the conventional versions of Christianity are the ones that are going to kind of rebirth or be resurrected.
Do you imagine that there will be? What do you imagine the emergent church will look like in 100 years?
Yeah, see, there's it's one
not,
of those hypotheticals.
It's not entirely. I was trying to rephrase it so it didn't come across as entirely hypothetical. But this is something that I know you must have given thought to.
I try not
That's
to.
That's not
actually
a what if question.
No,
it's
I try to discipline myself not to think about that because I don't know. I mean, for sure, I think I and my friends are trying to develop rhythms of life and patterns of life that will be beneficial for our children and grandchildren. But what they do with it, God bless them. I hope they do something beautiful with it. That's what we're trying to do.
You can find Tony Jones online at emergentvillage.org. His new book is called The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier. It will soon be released in paperback. Tony, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so
much.
Thanks,
Chris. Thanks.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.